Okay, so I was asked to give some kind of a review of the electron glass problem and, well, explain what are the salient features which make it interesting, and I think also to explain a bit what are major open questions. So there will probably be parts that are trivial for those who have been in the business for 30 years and parts that are so open that none of us know the answers, and I would actually want to just contribute to showing what are probably interesting questions to attack. Okay, so let me start with the review part. So what is a Coulomb or electron glass? The term has been created not by Efros and Shklovsky, who actually first looked at it, but then by Davis-Lee and Rice a few years later, who noticed that localized electrons with strong interactions somehow are a frustrated system with many metastable states, very much like a spin glass, no? And glass is called because it has very slow dynamics, Coulomb because electron interactions. Okay, so the definition is that this is an insulating system of disordered localized electrons. Electrons, not only that, with a strong Coulomb interaction. So,
but what is the element of frustration here? I mean, the interaction now of the same, all of the same sign.
Disorder competes with the interaction, okay? So the picture you may have in mind is you have, so first, localized electrons can be Anderson localization, that means strong disorder, which localizes all the wave functions. This can be so strong localization as in a lightly doped semiconductors, where these are just the bound states on donor atoms. Or it can be localization on a grain for granular systems. And the important thing is that there is some disorder, that means disordered energies, like the random energies you have for Anderson localized orbitals, or disordered energies of charging energies of grains, and you have strong Coulomb interaction. So now imagine that you have your system where the electrons can sit in orbitals like that, and this is these are random positions, as is usually the case. There are random energies associated to putting electrons in one of these orbitals, and you have strong, say, 1 over r, e squared over r interactions between occupied orbitals. Now, if you have to put, say, 3 electrons into 6 orbitals like that, without interactions, you would put the electrons into the states with the smallest energies. With interactions, you have to find the best compromise between on-site energies and repulsion, and that's a frustrated problem. That's very hard to find the best configuration if you have a large system. Okay, same problem as finding the ground state of a spin glass system. That's also very hard. Okay, so this is a frustrated problem, and I think that was the element that made Davis-Lee and Rice call this a glass. That's of course not enough necessarily to give you macroscopic timescales that you can observe as being glass in there, but we'll come back to that. Okay. Now, so
Marcus, yes. Already you know familiar about the Panovsky probability, for example, that there are many pseudo constants.
Yes.
That you have many valence structures.
Right.
This is not only
No, okay, the term is due to them. The realization that this is maybe glass, you may have been come earlier, I don't remember.
Sorry, I missed the
So examples again that is either Anderson localized insulators, So that are dirty semiconductors where these blobs that I was drawing are just localized wave functions where the electrons can sit or not sit. And that's kind of the standard model that people look at, which we have seen many times in talk so far. No? And the Hamiltonian would be something like this. I and J are the sites where the electrons can sit, and on each side you can only put one electron or not. So you look at the spin polarized case, you don't care about spin. So you have the occupation number, which is 0 or 1. You have coupling, which is E squared Rij, usually, because you have no screening. There are no metallic electrons that make that screen. And you have the disorder. Okay. So these are random energies, and these energies belong to, say, some interval minus WW. Okay. And now if this W is of order, or say even bigger than E squared over the typical distance A between localized sites, then you have a strong competition between this term and that is expected to drive the system glassy. Okay. But so this is not the only example where you might look for an electron glass, and actually in such system usually you don't find these interesting features that Zvi and others are studying, but rather you find them in granular systems. So in granular systems you have metallic grains, say on top of a surface, and you can put charges here or here. There's a random charging energy associated to putting an electron here or here, and there's interaction between those. And so again, you may think in some limits you can approximately describe the system with this Hamiltonian.
So Ni is not 0 or 1.
No, but Ni, okay, so now for the grain I, Ni will be either big Ni or Ni plus 1 under certain conditions, okay? Under certain conditions. If this holds, I'll discuss then, then you can just renormalize this to be 0 and this to be 1, and then you're back at that Hamiltonian, okay? There are also quench condensed films, which probably have a similar microstructure. This is maybe not directly grains, but still something quite inhomogeneous. And here in this class of systems, there's this indium oxide in particular, which is a kind of exceptional case of a semiconductor which has very high density before it becomes metallic. And so you can reach much higher densities than in standard semiconductors. And in that exceptional case, and in these cases of the granular systems, you see actually these glass effects that we always hear about. And one of the major questions which is completely unresolved is, why do you see glass effects only in these systems and not in the semiconductors? And I will at least hint at what might be the reason later. Okay. So, so the picture now which you should have in mind, this was looking from above onto your localized states. Now I look from the side. And here's energy space, and here's real space. So, and now we go back to the semiconductor picture. Here I have a Fermi level. Fermi level just means the chemical potential. Of course, not the plane waves Fermi level as we are used to from metals. And in real space, I have these localization sites, wave functions, which live at random energies, like that. And are localized in different spatial regions. No? So now the typical spread here, the bandwidth, if you want, of this impurity band, that's called, that's this W that I introduced here. Okay, and
I'm intentionally making them very big, functions, almost touching each other.
Okay, yeah, so that now depends on what model you are looking at. If you look at lightly doped semiconductors so far away from the metal insulator transition, then these things are very small, well separated. If you approach the metal insulator transition, the localization length, this thing here, this spatial extent, which is called xi localization, grows and grows. The Anderson transition would be when this length diverges at the chemical potential. With interactions, the problem is not resolved. We don't understand how interactions and disorder play together at the metal insulator transition, but still you may think that before you become a metal, these wave functions will strongly overlap. And when you are in this case, then it's very useful to introduce a further energy scale, namely, you now look into a so-called localization volume. So you pick out a region of space which has linear size xi, and you ask what is the typical distance between localized wave functions that overlap significantly with this spatial region. So you ask what is this distance here?
In energy.
Energy in this case, yes. And that's called the level spacing, often denoted delta xi. Okay. Of course, for a dilute semiconductor, this has no meaning. But for all systems where we see glassy behavior, really, level spacing is a very important quantity. And this energy scale will have to be compared with interactions, actually. So let's come back to this Hamiltonian. So this was the disordered energy. So these will be the values here, the heights. Here, I should say that if I'm more accurate, there's also a dielectric constant here, which tells you how strong the Coulomb interactions are. Maybe I'll come back to that later. The important thing is that you have unscreened interactions, 1 over R, because there are no conduction electrons. Right. Okay, and one last thing I want to mention is the notion of density of states. All of us in principle know what the density of states is. BOS. It's the number of states, localized states, that you find per region of space and per interval of energy. And this is a relatively constant quantity, independent of how disordered you make your stuff. If you increase the localization length by decreasing the disorder, then you just have more states crossing this this interval, but the spectral weight remains the same. So the density of states doesn't change if you change the localization length. And so this level spacing is related actually to the density of states as just being roughly 1 over the density of states and the localization volume. So, or you can rewrite this as density of states is basically 1 state per localization volume and per level spacing. That's exactly what the density of states is supposed to mean. How many states do you have per space?
This all makes sense when you are in critical range of insulator metal transitions.
Yes, so when these
lightly doped semiconductors, it doesn't make sense.
Right. Yeah, as I said before. Right. Okay. So now you may ask, if you are in this situation here, does it make sense at all to take this simple semiconductor picture? You might say, no, it doesn't make sense at all because you have so many states actually at the same place in space. And so why should I even write 1 over R? I mean, here I don't have point-like particles like in semiconductors roughly. But there's a regime where this is still a good approximation for such a situation, very similar to here for the granular system. Namely, if the interaction between an occupied state here and an empty state here is smaller than this level spacing, then you can say, well, all these states below the chemical potential will be occupied, maybe up to the last one. And the last one, you don't know whether it's occupied or empty, but the interactions will not change the occupation down here, but only here. Then you can reduce yourself again to 0 or 1, which means this empty or occupied, and the rest you leave away. And so under the condition that a typical interaction within the localization volume, which is E squared over kappa, the electric constant xi, which is now the spatial distance between these localized electrons in the same volume, if this is smaller than delta psi, then you can hope that the standard model here may apply. Okay. There may be some subtle quantum effects that are still missed, but for thermodynamic considerations, this should be a good model. For example, if you want to know whether this is a glassy or a non-glassy system. Okay, so I like to call this the classical Coulomb's glass, because it reduces basically the electrons to point-like particles that sit on certain sites I. Here we drew them as lines, but effectively you can replace the lines by points, and you have just interactions between these points. So it's a kind of classical particles, and the tunneling between one state and another, mediated by a phonon, only plays a role once you look at transport, and this tunneling is so weak that it doesn't affect the thermodynamics of the Hamiltonian.
The temperature does play any role?
No, not for this consideration. I mean, for this thing to become interesting, the temperature should be smaller than delta psi. We should be in the hopping regime for transport. Otherwise, you are in a high temperature regime and you don't even see localization probably. Okay.
But this standard model ignores kinetic energy.
Well, the kinetic energy is sub-summarized in here, you know? So you say, I solved the Anderson problem, it's localized. I have my orbital, everything is in here. The only thing that remains are exponentially small corrections of, you know, the wave function leaking out and having overlapping state over here. And that would come in here in principle as a hopping term. But in the standard model, this T is much, much smaller than all the other scales. Even exponentially smaller. And so you can.
Because the standard model applies to well separated.
Yes.
It's only little overlap. But this regime you are now discussing is deeper.
Right.
And that's a little bit of. When you say this is difficult, because if it is exponentially small overlap, then Xi is equal to Bohr radius. It's very small, and states are not overlapping in space.
Yeah.
And the picture which you drew makes sense only near metal-insulated transition, where Xi is much bigger than Bohr radius.
Yeah.
Xi is much bigger than average distance between particles, because transition happens in the vicinity where product of concentration and Bohr radius cube is of order one.
Yes.
And so Xi is much bigger than A.
Yeah.
And then Xi itself is formed due to tunneling and hybridization of cluster, of percolation-like cluster, finite cluster of single donors, say, which are combined by tunneling.
Yes.
Tunneling is included.
Yeah. Okay.
And that tunneling sits in definition of Xi.
Right.
And so you're mixing like it's two cases.
Okay.
That's difficult to discriminate for people.
Yeah, I agree with you. So I should not write this term like this. When I wrote this, I should actually put here a phonon term too. So in order to get transport in that model, you would want interaction, inelastic processes that can take you from the localized states to other localized states. And that, since you have diagonalized your disordered problem, and indeed you get this complicated wave function to live on many sides, you only can do by either scattering from a phonon or scattering from other electrons, which would correspond to off-diagonal parts of the Coulomb interaction, which I haven't written here, but which become important if you're in the opposite limit.
Well, this is not exactly kinetic again, because this is for transport.
Yes.
Without transport, you can write C plus C term, like in Anderson.
Yes.
That term, without phonons, makes large wave functions.
Yes, of course, yeah. So these wave functions that I'm drawing are already the diagonalized solutions of a problem where you have a local disorder, E of x plus C dagger.
Marcus, you say that you may solve Anderson problem without interactions.
Yes.
Well, then come to this Gamiltonian.
Right. And then, of course, there would be off-diagonal parts of the Coulomb interaction, which have dropped, right? But
to find Xi,
yes,
if there is interaction, you should include interaction.
You can include them in a Hartree fog-like manner, no?
If interaction is weak, you might see it like that. That's what
so under this condition, okay?
Do we understand correctly that you doubt this Kanban model? Or not?
Huh? Sorry?
Is there this discussion leading to a doubt of this Kanban model, or is it just interpretation of parameters?
So I'm saying the following. So the systems where we see interesting glass effects are actually systems which look like this in reality. And so a priori would say this has nothing to do with those systems, so we cannot say anything. But I'm arguing as long as there's maybe this inequality, you can still get back to this model and say that is a good description, even though you have overlapping wave functions.
Why do you think so? It seems to me that you should add here Anderson term with overlap and solve it all together. But that you already did.
I already did. Yes,
no,
I think.
Without interaction.
This Xi already counts.
Where is interaction? Xi contain interaction.
Okay, so in the opposite regime.
Double taking can take out interaction.
You have to. You can take interaction only into account in an average sense, and then hope that this gives you a reasonably.
And entering the residual interaction as a residual interaction.
Right. Exactly.
Difficult to separate.
Yes, that's difficult to separate. But okay, I just want to tell you that maybe there's some reason to believe that this doesn't only describe semiconductors, in which case we cannot explain anything of the experiments by doing what has been done.
Think the electric constant should be completely different.
Yes, it will be different indeed. It will be larger than the bare dielectric constant.
No, it should. Q dependent.
Yes, it will be Q dependent, but it will be the kappa of roughly of psi. Okay. So I'm just saying if you take. Now, if you take this regime, then hell breaks loose, and that's the approach to the metal insulator transition, which is very interesting and very, very complicated. And this is probably still a glassy problem, but clearly has all kinds of quantum fluctuations in it, because you have off-diagonal parts of the Coulomb interaction, so there will be terms like this. NK, and there will be terms like that, etc. On top of those, and that gives very strong quantum fluctuations, which you have to take into account. And very little is known about that. Okay. Very little is understood, but that is presumably the regime which is certainly approached with indium oxide. Okay. Or indium oxide might be at the border here. But the fact that there is this border which becomes dangerous might be connected to the fact that semiconductors show no observable glassy features and indium oxide does. So on granules. Well, you write your Coulomb interaction in a basis of Anderson localized wave functions, which that don't take everything into account, and then there are off-diagonal terms. Okay.
Sorry, I just wanted to. So you said most of what is interesting in this kind of aging glass experiments, mm-hmm. right, happens in this situation, but then you remapped it with renormalization of parameters, etc., into roughly the same model, at least for some cases.
Yeah, in that case.
Those cases might have the interesting phenomena, or that you're.
That's not clear.
That's not clear, but you would perhaps be claiming that only the bottom line have.
That could be. It could be, yeah. And that's that one of the major big issues in this field, namely, as Zvi always points out, as in semiconductors, you see nothing of his stuff. He sees it, and granular systems see it. The obvious density difference is density, but with density comes also the fact that you are closer to this regime. And so
I disagree. That last regime exists in semiconductors too.
Yes.
Semiconductors near metal oscillator transition are objects of large density, and the same. And so this regime is
yes.
there too, and there are no such phenomena. So I don't see how you going between two rocks.
I agree with you. If you go in semiconductors really to the transition, in principle, you should get into this regime. In principle, there might maybe be a glass effect. If they are still not there, then it's probably merely a question of density, or it's an artifact. Okay. So, but I'm just saying, there are these two cases, and only this case is well studied, and this is a very complicated but very interesting one, because it connects quantum glassiness with the delocalization transition and the quantum phase transition from the insulator to the metal, etc. So there are actually many, many interesting things that may happen here and which are worthwhile studying, I think.
Then one should add one small remark, an experiment. The concentration region where you can measure conductivity reasonably related to typical Hopping features is all, it is not less than one decay below the metal insulator transition. so it's a bit surprising why we see it in one situation and the other not, but maybe.
Well, you see, Xi is a very strong function at the metal insulator transition. So, if the distinction between these two regimes is important, then if you are 50% away from the transition, then you are already very strongly in that regime.
Nobody can measure 50%.
Okay, 75%. Okay. So.
Which limit would there be a
Wigner crystal would be at very low density, actually, and I mean all these that
very small disorder.
Yeah, very
small, and there is no disorder.
Yeah, so if you think in terms of Wigner crystal, you may maybe think of the Coulomb glass as a extremely highly disordered Wigner crystal, where the defects have proliferated such that the defect density is as much as the density of electron. Yes?
Question. I thought that your original work on the Wigner crystal includes kinetic energy, but the kinetic energy away. So
right.
I was simply saying that it is a charged order phase.
That's a misnomer. But if you start from a Wigner crystal and you increase the disorder, you can ask, how do I get here? So at the disorder will compete with the kinetic energy, will localize, and the interactions will still be there, but you're just left with the charge ordered phase, which is crystalline but somehow glassy order.
I think it's true that if you make epsilon I very small and you take the density very small also, you will get an ordered phase on the fake lattice.
Yeah.
And then if you put a little bit of disorder, you will reasonably disorder this big crystal. But you will still miss the quantum terms, because this Hamiltonian has no quantum terms. So you miss the quantum terms, which are the vibrations of the crystal, quantum vibrations.
So Arnold is just saying that call something Wigner crystal, you should have the kinetic term, otherwise you should call it the classical crystal. Okay, that's terminology. So essentially I see the ratio of these things as a parameter which can distinguish between materials, and there is obviously also just the density of electrons times localization volume, which is the number of electrons per localization volume, which is in principle a parameter that is independent of this ratio. And so this and that parameter may differ from system to system, and that may in principle make the difference between semiconductors and granular systems, etc.
I think that here you ignore Coulomb gap. And if you take into account Coulomb gap in density of states, then delta psi, delta sub psi, delta, will be exactly this x squared over kappa c.
Yes, that's right.
And so it will be no two regimes. It will be one regime, universal regime.
No.
Two quantities are equal.
No, I agree with the first half of the statement, but the second statement, I define this as being a non-interacting quantity. I define it as this, no?
Yeah, but then it should be renormalized when you enter this regime.
Yeah, okay. Right, so the effective level level spacing that you get after having taken into account the Coulomb gap will be this thing, indeed.
Yeah.
But this will be a result of strong Coulomb interaction, and it's still so that there's a well-defined different regime.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Then clinicians stuck to each other.
Yes.
So these are the bare parameters, and
you can remember as one? Yeah, they are bare in the sense of speak interaction. At the moment the interaction becomes strong, they become equal. And so opposite inequality never actually exists.
I would say that the quantum effects will start not at low energy in terms of epsilon, but in dipoles, because dipoles will overlap, first of all, not electrons.
If we come to the picture of the grain, then clearly we have two scales. One is the Coulomb energy of each grain, and the other one is the level spacing of the grain. So I don't understand your statement. They are equal.
No, what he's saying is once you establish the Coulomb gap, and now you ask what is the difference between Hartree-Fock states, including all the interaction, then you will find that the effective level spacing after doing all this will be this. And I fully agree with that. But nevertheless, I can introduce this parameter to characterize what's happening. Okay, so now we said much about this Coulomb gap, and some people here are not familiar what Coulomb gap means. So let me very briefly review what this is. So what are these the hallmarks of the Coulomb glass? And now I'm basically going back to this standard model, because while this is very interesting, we have rather little to say. So we start with the following energy distribution of states. So there is basically a constant density of states, which is 1 over W, and it goes from minus W to W, say, something like this, that would be put in the model. And now you ask, what is the effect of these interactions? And briefly, the effect will be that there is a suppression of the density of states around the chemical potential, which is zero if you have a half-filled system where half the sites are empty, half are occupied.
What is the definition of the
Hamiltonian? Yeah, so let me define that. So you take the Hamiltonian, you say, how much energy do you pay if you change the occupation of site I by one? This you call the on-site energy or the local field. And this is from this formula, it seems to be epsilon I, the on-site energy plus interaction with all other sites, which is this term here. And now you can ask, how is this object distributed in a typical configuration of occupations? So you define a density of states, which is 1 over number of sites, sum over sites of delta EI minus E. And this is just the classical limit of the normal density of states that we define via Green's function, the imaginary part, pi of the local Green's function. Okay, so if you have very little tunneling between localized sites, then you reduce to this when you write down the quantum expression for density of states. Okay, so if you plot this in a typical metastable state of this classical Hamiltonian, you find this this suppression of the density of states. And Jorge has told us about the SK model, where you find something very similar when you look at the distribution of local fields in a spin glass. Then you find a linear suppression at small fields. Here you find with 1 over R interactions something that goes like e to the t minus 1, where d is the dimension. And these two things have exactly the same origin. So what is the origin? The thing is that if you are in a metastable state, then if you had too many sites where this energy is very small, then you would have an instability. And you remove this instability by flipping two spins here or by removing a particle from an occupied state to an empty state. And this digs a hole in the density of states. And only with this hole, a configuration is at least metastable towards single particle transition. So to establish that, you think of real space. Here's energy space. You have the chemical potential. You have an occupied site here with a large E below mu. And here you have an empty site above. And now you ask, does it cost me energy to put the particle from here to here, or do I gain energy? How could you gain energy? Well, if you remove the particle here and you put it there, then you pay the energy E1. You pay also the energy E2, but you gain the energy that you double counted in from this term here, which is E squared over R12. And so the state is only stable if you always have to pay energy, so this always has to be bigger than zero. And so you have to make sure that this term is never bigger than this here. So you have to make sure that you cannot have too many soft sites, low energy sites, close together. And so everyone, Shklovsky in 1975, analyzed the stability criteria and came up with the condition that this density of states must be suppressed more and more as you go to the chemical potential. These sites must be further and further apart, and it must be certainly smaller than some constant here with units e to the 2d, some number here, and here d minus 1. And that's a simple stability criterion based on this. Now, why this bound on this exponent is really saturated and why it's not just an upper bound has remained kind of a a debate. I mean, one can say, well, why should it not saturate? Because this is the only criterion for stability. So it looks likely that you would saturate this bound. But a real, say, rigorous argument cannot really be given. In the SK model, you can really calculate it, and you can prove that this upper bound is saturated. And the electron glass from mean field theory, which patterns will act according to SK, you can also sort of prove that this would happen. Okay, so by now it's almost firmly confirmed by also by numerics that this exponent is probably always t minus 1. Right. Good. So to see that in the SA model you get 1, just for people who were interested in this question, how could you get it from a similar argument? Well, think of the SK model as a system with a large number of points where n is r to the d, the volume of a sphere like this. The interactions between most of the points, if d is large, would be just 1 over r with Coulomb interactions. If you want to mimic SK, where the interactions are 1 over square root of n, then you better put 1 over r to the d half as interactions. So interactions between particles would be 1 over r to the d half. You put that back into the stability argument, and lo and behold, you find an exponent here that is 1.
I don't understand what is d here.
D would be the dimension of the space, and if
in this case, this is infinity, right?
In which case?
Kirkpatrick,
no, I'm making an analogy. A finite size SK model with a large dimensional hypersphere, and I'm saying if they are in a large dimension, you can consider that you mostly interact with the people at the boundary. If this interaction goes like 1 over r to the d half, you have something like an SK-like model, and if you put that back, you get the exponent
one. But d disappears from this analysis.
Yes, that's right. But the two suggest that
it's different from Verkhoshkovsky, where d is important.
Yes.
And so this d is fictitious.
Right. But that's just to make the analogy as good as possible. You can also argue here you take this the soft spin here, and you flip it, and you flip also the spin, the softest one here, and you ask if this is stable, equal to that consideration, and you get the inequality that tells you that h1 plus h2 minus j1, j2 should be bigger than 1. This is 1 over square root of n, and you find that this scales like 1 over square root of n only if they have a linear slope here.
Yeah, so essentially this model behaves as two-dimensional case in Verkhoshkovsky. In Verkhoshkovsky, if you do two dimensions, you get linear behavior. And here too, the reason that it behaves like two-dimensional is that I is 1 over square root of n, and only in the case of 2d, where d is 2, this becomes Coulomb.
Yeah, right.
But simultaneously, D makes no sense, and it's a very strange thing.
Okay. So maybe one remark in our treatment via mean field of the Coulomb glass, we found that that exponent actually thanks to the marginality of the spin glass space, or the glass space. And that means that there are basically very soft excitations in the glass phase, and the phase is not a very stable phase with it. Of the glass phase.
May I ask a question on your trigonometry? Mm-hmm. Coulomb has been detected by
No, the SK model is not experimentally realized. So it has been seen in numerics.
But it has some features.
Okay, so if you look at in a finite dimensional short range spin glass, you will have something like this. And this will be finite. There will always be spins in zero field, essentially. And that goes like 1 over dimension or connectivity, basically. So in higher dimensions, you will have a stronger and stronger gap. But it's never so that this goes to zero. For going to zero, you need long-range interactions, which you only have in SK or in the Coulomb case with one of the others.
It is an artifact of the model.
Yes, yeah, of the long range, fully connected. Right. Okay.
I just want to say that this model is completely unphysical.
Yes, let me say that in one dimension, you take Gauss and input it correctly. In one dimensional spin glass, if you take Gaussian interactions, then you have a linear thing. For reasons that I don't understand, but this is numeric.
Short range? Or
yes, yes, yes. First nearest neighbors, but random. And this is a model that is not as mad as SK.
That's strange. Okay, so, but that
one dimensional nearest neighbor, one dimensional neighbor random, so one dimensional nearest neighbor random interaction.
Hmm. But that must be based on.
And Gaussian distribution for continuous distribution for the couplings.
Continuous distribution of what?
Of intensity of couplings. So it's not either plus or minus one, but Gaussian.
Okay.
I don't know what's the significance.
Okay, so Boris says SK model is completely unphysical. I don't quite agree, actually. I mean, it helped understanding certain features of spin glasses, but it might also be very interesting for actually understanding this case here. Because when you have a lot of actively interacting wave functions or electrons in the same volume, it's fully connected within this volume, and if you have a large number of them, you get to systems that look a bit SK-like, and I think that this may be a fruitful way to think about that case. Okay. A final little remark about the density of states, and then I want to leave that part, is that this prediction was actually made for polaron excitations, so not just these single site excitations. Everyone in Shklovsky were very careful to realize that there are dipoles around, and if you include these dipoles, then you wouldn't believe really this law for this object at low energy. And I think this belief is still up, and then starts to be maybe confirmed. But at very low energy, there would be a deviation here, and this law only holds for somewhat collective excitations, which are also the excitations that you can capture by any other mean field sort of consideration. So one shouldn't worry too much if in numerics you see some deviations from that law, because after all,
what are the deviations in this direction?
It is more suppressed, slightly. Eventually, it would be exponentially suppressed for this quantity. But this is an entirely academic question, I think, because the distribution of this object has almost no physical importance. Okay, so what is the importance of this Coulomb gap? Consequences of the Coulomb gap, just briefly. So Jorge said that this linear gap in the SK model has no observable consequences. Well, one observable consequence would be that susceptibility goes down, like is linear in temperature rather than or like temperature squared, or the specific heat, because like T squared and not like T, which you would have if you had no gap. But that's about the only consequence in that model. And that's, and in finite dimensional spin glasses, this doesn't occur, so it's not so interesting. The analog of that in the Coulomb glass would be a compressibility, kind of zero field cooled compressibility when you don't change your state, which goes like T squared rather than constant. And if you look at the field cooled compressibility, if you change your gate voltage and then go down in temperature rather than the opposite, you get the constant compressibility. If you do it opposite, then you get T squared if you don't overdo it. So this is zero field cool, so to speak, and this is field cool.
How do you define the compressibility?
Dn, d mu. Change in charge by changing gate voltage.
And the
mu
is temperature independent.
Well, no, not at finite temperature.
Finite temperature is
not temperature independent.
Why? It depends on
because the density of state is.
Nothing in common with the antimatter. Because if you add electrons, just Coulomb gap moves on another position.
Thermal level moves.
Nothing happens.
So
the
mu is always constant.
Yeah. It's thermodynamic density of states. And specific heat is also always T.
I think if the dynamics is very slow and if there's some glasses, then you will see.
No.
Yeah, let's,
no? There's no dependence on any of this. It doesn't depend on what gate voltage you put.
But in linear response, okay. So don't take it too seriously. Maybe this would only hold on short time scales and would be wiped out. But
actually, it's microsecond, less than microsecond.
Yeah. Okay. Time. Right. Okay. That's maximal time. Yeah. You may be right. Yes.
When you
right. Okay.
And so
right. Okay.
No T square. Can be observed.
Right, okay. But if you had no hopping, then that would be correct. So if you add phonon-assisted hopping, then it's gone, and you don't observe this ever. Okay, good. So more important is that you see this gap in tunneling, because tunneling measures the density of states. That's very difficult because it tunnels into an insulator and not in a metal. But it has been achieved by Mark Lee, I think. And you see it most importantly in transport, in the variable range hopping. So this would be the Eckhoff-Shklovsky hopping, which gives you stretched exponential behavior. So e to the minus t naught over t to 1/2. And the t naught actually knows about Coulomb interactions and would just be e squared over kappa xi. Okay. This has been observed many, many times, and how exactly you arrive to this formula is sometimes debated, but there's no doubt that this occurs because of the Coulomb gap. What is a much more contentious question is about the free factor here. So here there would be an R0. And many experiments closing up to the metal insulator transition show that this is almost universally of the order of h bar over e squared, say in two dimensions or some other length scale here in three dimensions. As first noted, I think, by Boris, and that is ubiquitous. But the standard theory of phonon-assisted hopping for variable range conductance would give you a prefactor that is much bigger than that. And that has been an open problem to explain how this can come about at all, because it suggests that the transport is assisted by electron-electron interaction and phonon.
So I had a question. You've been comparing these two models and saying one can be used to describe the physical behavior of the other one. So what's the formal mapping between the models?
Which model and which?
The one on this side, the Anderson one with the Sherrington SK model.
No, I say that there's a similar feature in the two models, and because it's a,
so when you say similar features, you're visually comparing the graphs and you're saying that, or is there a formal mapping which maps?
No, there's no formal mapping. No, there's just a similar object. Here it's called the density of states. Here it's called the distribution of local fields. They both have a pseudo gap. Pseudo gap has different exponents. Just saying the origin
but
of this.
A lot of other systems can have pseudo gap also. Why would not retain those?
Because the origin of the pseudo gap is the same mechanism.
So has that been proved that the origin is the same for both?
Well, I have calculated this and this with the same method essentially.
Okay,
similar method.
Okay, that's what I wanted.
Yeah, similar method.
Okay. The reason for left model is the correlations in space, mm-hmm. in real space. Second model has no real space.
That's space.
No. Interaction doesn't depend on distance, so nothing can be said about correlations in space. This is the difference.
Okay. So now a side remark for people not so familiar with insulators. So here we see that the resistance is large. It's plus, of course, very large, but it's not infinite. So it's different from say pin interfaces or the pinned Wigner crystal, which would have an R of T at the finite electric field, which is just zero because everything is blocked and nothing moves. If you apply an electric field in the Coulomb glass, if you apply an electric field to a Wigner crystal, for example, then it just doesn't move. In DC, because the whole crystal cannot move, and so it's that has to do with the topological connectivity of the crystal. You don't create defects, and the defects are moving when you make the approximation that the crystal remains intact, and that gives rise to this spinning, roughly speaking. In these Coulomb glasses, you can have finite transport because you have a lot of defects, and the defects can move. So you an electron here can hop with assistance from some phonon, hop over here, and then with another phonon over here, and you can get transport through the whole sample. The transport is very bad because you need a phonon to absorb, and usually there's an energy difference. So this is real space. And now if I plot that in energy space, you may have to go up in energy and then you go down in energy and up again. Whenever you go up here, you have to absorb a high energy phonon, and the energy typically that you have to absorb is much bigger than temperature. Actually of the order of this T0 square root of T0 times T square root of it. So this becomes much larger than T when T is low, and so the transport is very much hampered. Okay, but nevertheless you get finite transport. Now what is the best transport path through your sample is actually a question of temperature and of the density of states close to the Fermi level. So to see this, well, for each such transition, you have to pay two bad factors. One is the e to the minus delta e over t, which is the probability to find the phonon for this transition. And on the other hand, you have to pay a matrix element squared, and the matrix element which comes due to the phonon distorting the crystal, goes like exponentially in this distance. If this distance is much larger than the localization length psi, it is exponentially small.
In this graph is an oversimplification with the answer
that you know. Yes, of course. But order of magnitude wise, this is still correct. So now, just to see that the best path to get conductivity is sensitive to temperature. If temperature goes low, then you will prefer to hop further and pay less in energy and pay more in this factor. So the lower the temperature, the longer you make hops, and the resistivity goes up, but not in an Arrhenius fashion, but slower. Second thing is the delta E here is very important. And if you have a low density of states, a low number of states around the chemical potential, then this term will be suppressed. And so the conductivity is certainly sensitive to whether you have a gap around, a pseudo gap around the chemical potential or not. And so if you didn't have and you had a non-interacting system, you would find a law instead which would grow much. Much less quickly, like 1 over t plus 1 in dimensions. So that's the famous mode variable range hopping, as opposed to the Frosch-Klofsky, which is a direct manifestation of this Coulomb gap. Okay. So just to fill in people about variable range transport. I think the main, really main interesting open question is not so much to understand exactly how big this T naught is and whether it's 2 or 3 here, but to understand this prefactor and how it comes about that this seems to be of electronic nature. And that connects to the talk we had by Boris Altshuler, who told us that when interactions are weak between electrons and everything is localized, then interactions will not allow you to make transport. You need phonons. But we know that if we needed phonons, then this prefactor would be much bigger. So apparently, most experiments which show this order of magnitude of the prefactor don't need phonons. And so there is transport, even if the phonons don't play a significant role. And that needs to be explained. And it's probably still somewhat open question how this can come about. But presumably, this regime here is an important ingredient in understanding that.
They may need phonons, but phonons apparently don't enter in final results. So
right.
It can be unitary limit of something.
That's right.
Where phonons play the role, like Boris was talking about Baron Munchausen, you remember?
Right.
So
that might be.
Who hanged himself by.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So phonons may be playing some role, but they disappear from the answer.
Right.
This is one of situations possible. Nobody knows what's true.
Right. In any case, that would be. Well, just to finish the thought, that it would not be in contradiction to what Boris told us, because this regime certainly is way beyond the applicability of what he was talking about. The ratio between these two quantities is basically what he called lambda, his perturbation parameter, and this needed to be small. And here, that would be exactly the opposite limit. So. There's no contradiction. Yeah?
I would like just to know, if one does experiments, the important point is that T0 vanishes if one approaches with transition. And if you now look at the fixed temperature, you certainly get some, if you approach with transition, somewhere to a point where temperature T cannot be smaller at T0, right? It would be interesting to also to understand. Or to get a quantitative description of what happens then, and since this exponential form is certainly only a limit, but as well as t is small compared to t0.
Yeah, but you see, a partial answer can already be given. As Boris correctly pointed out, that the effective level spacing you have when you're close to the main wavelength transition will be this thing here. Temperature is bigger than this, what we call T0 over there, then then you are not in the hopping regime, and so you are in the okay. If temperature is bigger than T0, which is this thing, which is the level space, the renormalized level spacing, then you are expecting that you're in the so-called power law hopping regime. Okay, so now the details of that is left to. Left to work out, I guess, if that can be worked out at all. Okay. Good. So so far I described the standard features like the Coulomb gap and transport, but what we are actually really interested about is the glossy features. And so I briefly review what are the standard experiments that puzzle us, and then try to raise mostly questions about it. Okay, so actually I have no idea what the time is doing. So tell me when I should stop, because okay. One last thing we need to mention about transport is this famous Maxwell time, which several people might not know. So you can just ask basically how long does it take for a critical hop to take place. There are many small hops, but to get percolation, for example, there are some critical resistors, critical hops that are very long or very high in energy, and they are the bottlenecks of transport, okay? So you can ask how frequent is such a hop that gives you a hopping time, and this hopping time is essentially the same as what the people call the Maxwell time, and it is, I think, how do I have to put it? Yeah, it's in three dimensions, it would just be a typical length scale, say the localization length times the resistance. So if the resistance is large, this hopping time becomes large, but it's actually not that large. So what the typical resistance can be, that's maybe gigaohm. In two dimensions, you wouldn't need this factor. Now, this factor is still there. Something like this. If you have a gigaohm and say 10 nanometers of localization length or so, then the hopping time is maybe only 1 nanosecond, okay? Something of that order. If you have very high resistance, it maybe comes to microseconds, and as Efros mentions. But these are very small timescales, even though these are still much bigger than, you know, typical 10 to minus 14 seconds, which are phonon frequencies or so. So this is much bigger than that, but much, 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 much smaller than even 1 second or 1 day, which people observing glossy effects are looking at, no? So the whole question is now, how can glossy features arise that live on this time scale if the natural time scale, the Maxwell time scale, lives on that scale? And that's the big puzzle that is, I think, still not resolved. Okay, so now what are these glossy features that we are talking about? So on one hand, we just see the effect of slow relaxation. And that's the simplest, maybe not even so glossy feature. So what do people do? They have usually quasi-dimensional.
Sorry, about this Maxwell time.
Yeah.
I mean, in other glass, it's been glassy, so structure and natural. There is nothing like this Maxwell time. Still, you have glassy relaxation, macroscopic timescales.
Yeah.
When the only macroscopic timescale you have is delta 1 as well.
Right. So it can happen indeed,
yeah.
But there is a time scale which is very short associated to moving charges around. And you may wonder, don't these moving charges destabilize what you want to be glossy? And it's an important point to make that no numerical simulation so far has shown anything that is slower than a Maxwell time. Actually, it's much, much faster than Maxwell time usually. So we have not any evidence numerically in the standard model here that anything would happen even near by this time. So now this raises the question, can there be something that lives here in the standard model, or is it just not a feature of the standard model? Do we have to go to invoke other physics? Okay, so briefly, let me explain what people do to observe glossy properties. That will be very cursory. So here will be the Coulomb glass sample, which is quasi 2D usually. Then there's a strong insulator here, and then there's a gate. And here you can apply a gate voltage. And this gate voltage introduces extra carriers into this Coulomb glass, and you can watch. This is an easy way to perturb the system, and you can watch what the system does as a function of time after you change the gate voltage, for example. So the simplest thing to observe is just.
Can I interrupt you for a second, please? I think the description is not fully correct. There are numerical works which show that there's a very broad spectrum of relaxation times. But nobody has really any hand to measure the conductivity on the screen.
That you can.
I remember works by Schreiber et al. From Chemnitz. I remember works from the Musia group.
Yes, but so, I mean, you can estimate.
From this day are existent.
Okay, so certainly there is evidence for a broad spectrum, but there is no evidence that the spectrum goes way beyond this time scale. And you can estimate this time scale even if you cannot measure it, and if you know that this time scale is much bigger than what you can simulate, then you have no evidence for anything going beyond the natural time scale of any experiment. Okay, you may have evidence for other experiments in much stronger insulators, but maybe not for what I described here.
Let me comment a little bit on your logic. So logic is very simple. He said, Maxwell said that if there is a resistivity, then resistivity divided by 4 pi is the relaxation time of charge in space, period. So Marcus says, although this resistivity is large, it's not large enough to explain these experiments. And so he is going now beyond relaxation time of charge and talks about relaxation time, who knows what, and this is the challenge.
Right, okay. So I described the who knows what. So what is done is you measure resistance or conductivity, sigma, or conductance maybe, as a function of a gate voltage. So first, you fix the gate voltage, you sit here, and you wait as a function of time. And what you see is a very slow relaxation, which goes down logarithmically. So delta G of T goes like minus log T. And in overall factors, it will be maybe up to roughly 10% of GT. OK. So there's this logarithmic relaxation, which is very ubiquitous, and it can last for more than days. Okay. Now you have relaxed, value, it would still relax, but now you stop, and now you look, what does the system do if I change the gate voltage? So I take out carriers, or I put more carriers. In a standard system, you would expect that the conductance goes up if you put carriers, and it goes down if you take out carriers. What happens here is that here indeed it goes up, but here it also goes up. And that's a clear out of equilibrium effect. Because if you waited over here long enough, then you would go down here. And indeed, that would be the natural thing that you would expect. So what is happening is that the relaxations that take place in that at that fixed point are sort of undone when you put in enough carriers. And you put the system again out of equilibrium, and it would take a long time to go back here. On this qualitative level, things are sort of understandable. Something is relaxing slowly, then you perturb it by changing carrier concentration, and then you have to relax something else again, etc. But what this something is, which relaxes so slowly and is so persistent, that is quite unclear, actually. Of course, there's several suggestions of what that may be, and I'll describe them later, but I think there is no real satisfactory explanation, especially of the time scale. So the interesting thing is when you now go to another gate voltage and you let relax here, and now you look what happens as a function of gate voltage by making a fast sweep, then you see still a memory of what you have done over here. And of course, here you will already see that relaxation is taking place. So you see two dips at the same time. And this first dip can survive for quite a long time scale, even though you're now relaxing at a different condition. And the time it takes to erase this dip completely is of the same time scale as time that you equilibrated at this. That's called aging. So the T to relax or to restore is about the same as the T which you equilibrated, so the system remembers this time scale and becomes sort of slower at the longer you wait. And there is memory, so this the first dip that you create by equilibrating here is memorized for a time that can be very long if you waited long enough in the first place. Okay, so the features that are not understood about this are the time scale. How can this be that this is so long persistent? Then the more microscopic features of the behavior of the widths with so this scale, maybe the amplitude and the shape as a function of carrier density, as function of temperature, etc. There are many interesting features that should be explained by a good theory, and I think there's nothing really fully successful doing that. But what I think is the greatest challenge is to find out what are the objects that are so slow and may relax. So the current common thinking is that it cannot be a single particle feature. It cannot just be certain electrons that somehow in your sample you may have percolation transport along such a path, or maybe along such a path. But in here you have a big desert area, and here there would be isolated sites that can not relax easily, and that would take for an electron to go from here to here would take much longer time than that Maxwell time. That is hardly possible to explain 15 orders of magnitude in time scale. Even though in a caricature model where the localization length is much, much smaller than the hopping length, such a phenomenon could occur that you have a huge separation of time scales on that percolation path and in here. But in the experimental systems under consideration, this is hardly an explanation. So no single particle effect. So then the...
Why? Why in principle couldn't you think about, you know, these very, very long hopping times outside of this?
Well, it just seems that the probability that a site would be much further isolated from other sites than the hopping length of the percolation path is so... This probability is so low that the effect of such events would be minuscule on conductivity. I mean, that would appear once in a square meter, and you don't have such events. So the typical slow things are a bit slower than the Maxwell time, but not much. So this insufficiently dense system. So from that you infer that probably if anything is slow, then it must be multi-particle relaxations. And why would these be slow? Well, if you have, say, a cluster of electrons that all have to flip together to make a relaxation, then the combined matrix element for that is so small that it can certainly lead to a higher time scale than the Maxwell time. But whether you can explain 15 orders of magnitude is still very, very questionable. So people have come up with certain models of what kind of classes of relaxers, multiparticle relaxers you might have, and which might be the dominant one to affect the conductivity on long timescales. And the idea is something of having a checkerboard pattern or something like that, which would be very slow. But whether this is really a consistent picture is not clear. But whether you can have configurations like that that can only relax in this way and not break up in faster relaxations, that has not been established. Maybe will never be established, but that's a big question mark, whether slow relaxers, yes, relaxers exist in the standard model in a reasonable density regime, of course. So
we have also a paper by Alexey Elfos and one of his pupils, I think it was Hobbes, who used to picture that the system moves from one local minimum to another. These are large structures, and consider the conductivity as property of these large peasants.
Yes, and then
that sounds to me logical.
Well, so this is a picture, and he measured something with different initial conditions, but he didn't check whether these were different values. He found all the conductivities to be essentially the same, and my suspicion is that he had only one value that he was seeing. And he didn't check that there were different values. This is just.
But if there's a huge hierarchy of values, everybody also makes mistakes.
Well, but it's not clear that you don't go from value to value when you have a finite temperature. And nobody checks that. So it would really be important for numerical people to establish that there are values that are clearly separated even much further than the Maxwell time. And so far we have no evidence of such a thing. So that could at least be a first path towards answering this question. But it could be eventually that these long, long timescales involve really quantum physics and the quantum Coulomb class. So you could think that that's an idea that is pushed by Zvi, because he sees the semiconductors and his systems are very different, and his systems are probably in this quantum limit. And his idea is that to have a multiple transition like that, if the energy difference between initial and final state is very close, then such a transition can be heavily affected by the Anderson orthogonality catastrophe. So the idea is that along with such transition, there comes a polarization of all other wave functions around it, and this the associated matrix element is strongly reduced, like in the X-ray. X-ray edge problem, and that might strongly enhance the time for relaxation. Whereas the same effect of Anderson orthogonality will not affect very much the percolation network. So maybe this is a route.
Just a question. Okay, here you wrote, let's say, a standard model, which has absolutely no dynamics.
Yes.
And okay, people might agree, disagree with the model, but at least more or less. Mm-hmm. This is something that can be studied. Is there an agreement on what dynamics? Okay, this is of course connected to what you were saying, but is there an agreement based on the fact that the dynamics will come from the overlap of localized wave functions or things like this, on what should be the time-dependent action or dynamics that should be written corresponding to this standard model?
Yeah, so what people always do in this business is writing down phonon-assisted hopping, even though the experimental observation points towards another mechanism. But that's the easiest thing that you can do, and that's what all people do.
Right, so the answer is no, essentially.
I mean, there is no agreement on what the dynamics are. It's unclear what type of dynamics should be added to the static standard model. Okay, and then be studied, be solved or studied or whatever, but even the what dynamical term should be added is unclear. This is what you're saying.
I think people do what they can do. Probably, if you press them hard, they would admit that you would have to have off-diagonal interaction terms, Coulomb interactions, and that would be the correct dynamic term. But then you're completely, I mean, then you're in a quantum glass problem, which almost not.
No, but if it's quantum glassy, you have to add a quantum term that will be responsible for the dynamics.
Right. Yes.
So people essentially do not know which term.
I think you would know what to write down, but people don't do that because it's hopelessly complicated. In the regime where you start having overlap between wave functions, if the wave functions don't overlap, then the Fourier-assisted hopping is fine, and what one does in numerics is also fine, and there is agreement certainly.
Yeah. So assuming that localization exists. Is it possible that the coupling with the percolation channels can produce this 10% change? Because then
no, that's not clear. Neither. So you have to come up with slow relaxes. Of course, you can always find some very rare event which is very slow. No, something that appears every 10 to the 15 years somewhere, but so this will be so rare that the effect will be minuscule, so that you cannot necessarily explain 10%. So if you want to explain everything, you have to put everything together.
What about the relaxation of the pattern of channels based on?
Huh?
What about the relaxation of the pattern of channels?
Yeah, so that's actually the whole idea of what is behind this relaxation of conductivity. That if something like this rearranges and the percolation network is changing too, and the conductivity changes in a biased way such that it statistically goes down. That's basically because if you have a charge sitting more often here than here, then this charge will try to polarize this thing, and there's a bias towards this thing relaxing so as to dig a deeper hole for that charge here, and that will nail down this charge more, and so the conductivity will be lower. So in that way, you can basically understand why the conductivity will go down, not up in relaxation. So now, how precise it would relax, of course, there's nothing much to be said. As long as we don't know these guys are exactly, how many of them there are, we can certainly not say how the percolation network changes. Okay. So far for the experimental problem of large timescales. Now, the way out of this debate might be if we can prove or show that there's a true glass transition in the standard model, then it would come naturally that there would be as long timescales as you want. So that's maybe the appeal of looking not directly at these dynamical questions, but at the thermodynamics of the phase and try to show that or that not there's a glass phase. And so far, I must say that the situation is still unclear, and I would like to briefly state where we are. So to make it relatively short, let me just say. So the a glass transition was supposedly found in a standard model where there was no disorder, just positional disorder in the positions, but not disorder on site. And there was a long-standing debate whether with on-site disorder there should be a glass transition. And so far, numerics hasn't shown it. Now, what should you actually look for if you look for a glass transition? So I think the salient feature that you would want to look at is correlations in the occupation numbers. So you look at the connected correlator between occupation of site I and site J. Now this, you know, at high temperatures will go like, well, it will be exponentially decaying with some length here. And this length is basically the screening length, which goes actually at low temperature, you may expect it goes like 1 over T. At high temperatures, it's just basically a constant. And there's a crossover around the temperature, which is the order of the Coulomb gap. Okay. Now, mean field theory, the one we put forward, would tell you that average over sites would still behave like that, but what doesn't behave like that is actually the analog of the nonlinear compressibility susceptibility, namely the square of this connected correlator, which at high temperatures also has a behavior like this, but at the supposed glass transition would become critical. So you have an exponential behavior like this, with an L2 of T, which would diverge at T going to TG, if TG existed. Okay? Now, that would be the best way of detecting a glass transition. And unfortunately, so far, people have at best looked at some sum over distances, which I believe to be potentially dominated by short distances. You have to be careful that you should look at this kind of behavior when this term goes away, and you should have critical correlations, like in spin glasses, by the way. You should look at that only when Rij is really bigger than this simple screening length, okay? Now, if you make a sum over distances, you are likely to be dominated by short-scale correlations, which may spoil the signal that you want to see. And so far, numerics has not been really conclusive in that question, I think. But maybe soon we'll have some answer.
So, no experiment, but
much
of
this
quantity,
although
we have not
If no, sorry, if
what would be a measurable quantity? But what indicated by any derivative in a specific heat or whatsoever?
Well, theoretically, yes. Practically, no. That's glass transition is never detected like this, it's only detected dynamically as a cusps in susceptibilities and which depend on frequency and so on. I think by taking a sample like this and making a direct measurement, you will not find the glass transition. I don't think.
But I ask also from the perspective of the analyst.
Yeah, but. Well, I don't think it's, the root via specific heat or so is not promising at all. That will be such a small signal that it will be completely covered by other effects, and you will never have the precision to extract it. That's known from spring glasses that this is a bad root. And you rather look at quantities like that. That's the way how, say, in 3D people found the spin glass transitions in the Edwards-Anderson model.
In the spin glass, this is.
Yeah, this.
From simulations.
Yeah. Simulations look at basically quantities like that.
They also look at nonlinear susceptibilities that you can somehow relate. They're not exactly to this quantity, but you can relate to this quantity.
What else can know, for example, on the.
So, for instance, they apply a strong field.
What does one know, for example, on an Eason system in 3D in random field?
You get spin glass in a running field?
Yeah.
Well, this is the discussion a little bit of yesterday, no? Whether there is a phase transition in a field or there is no phase transition in a field for a spin glass. People have different opinions about that. But without the field,
Yeah, without the field, this kind of technique is uncontested, so this works. With the field, the same method is interpreted differently.
In different ways.
Yeah, and so it's not clear. And so a similar method, like looking at that, has been applied by Matteo Balassini and Helmut Katzgraben and co-workers, but unfortunately, they were not looking at distance resolved result, but only at the sum over J here, and that may be contaminated or completely overshadowed by short distances. And so to really make a final point on the question, one should look at distance resolved correlation. So that's just an input for people doing these studies.
I'm sorry, one question about maybe the setting of the distance. If you switch off the random fields in your problem, is it well established that you have a phase transition?
I don't actually remember the status of this question. You might know that better. I mean, Claire, you had claimed that.
The question is the following. If you take a lattice model.
No, actually, we did that. Not a lattice
model. If you take this lattice model and switch on, consider a random field, so this epsilon, then you can draw a phase diagram of this type. Here's T, here is disordered strength, and here you have a charged ordered phase. And the big question is whether you have here such a kind of class transition. And what Matteo Palazzini's work shows is that we did not find an indication, but is. The point is always difficult to say that there is a thing not.
Right.
One has one, it's in our way. An amusing point is what we have to consider this point. If you use the usual numerical technique to obtain critical exponents, you get the values of a short range Ising model with high precision. You can exclude other things. So this Coulomb system is a bit of a chameleon. On the one hand, you have the long-range physics concerning the Coulomb gap, but concerning this order-disorder transition here, you have short-range physics.
But this was with a regular lattice, no?
This was regular lattice. And this you can also do, and what the group of Claire Yu did, they considered what happens if I start from a lattice and then disturb the positions. And in this situation, you have only spatial disorder, not random field. And for this reason, you have always two opposite ground states, just invert the system. And there, as far as I remember, we observed that the critical temperature went down, but this transition existed to have a large decrease of disorder. We did not show such a point.
Okay, so to summarize the situation, I think to settle the issue of this long time scale, it would be a shortcut to prove that there's a glass phase in the standard model, if there is one. If one doesn't find it, then it might be an indication that the standard model has no long time scales, or the challenge would be in constructing really convincingly such slow relaxers, which seems to be very difficult to construct them by hand. And the third possibility would be that these effects really rely on quantum effects which come from high density overlapping wave functions, etc., which are beyond the standard model. And in that situation, we would be in a relatively dying position. But it's that latter phase, close to the metal insulator transition, I think, that deserves much more attention and much deeper thinking, because that's a really exciting thing, I think. Quantum and disorder physics coming together. Okay, I'll just stop here then.